I think we still have a few minutes, as usual. We can start with a chit-chat session. Not that anybody chat with me. So mostly it's just my monologue. Yeah. Today we start a new series, a new course. I think it's called Working with Emotions. So the way I plan this Saturday meditation class is usually almost like every month, you know, out of 4 or 5 weeks, we have a different theme. So we take a few sessions to explore different themes related to meditation. So previously, I covered calm abiding meditation, which is a particular type of meditation for where the main sort of purpose or goal is to learn to calm the mind of the different disturbance including like distraction, agitation, lots of thoughts, as well as the opposite, which is downness, drowsiness. So when the mind is calm of all this disturbance, then it can, the attention, the mind can rest or abide comfortably, blissfully on whatever it is that you are meditating on. So this four sessions, we will explore a different theme, which is working with emotions through meditation. Yeah. So and each week, each session, we will probably do two meditation together. Yeah, and the two meditation will be on like two separate. I have two separate track, two separate ways to meditate that is related to working with emotions. Yeah. I think most people have attended some of my classes before. Okay, so we can start. And so working with emotions, the interesting thing is, in Buddhism, which is the background I'm presenting this meditation on, there isn't a word for emotions. Yeah. There is actually no equivalent word for emotions, which is an interesting thing, because over the years I thought about it. In English, we make a distinction. We make a kind of contrast between rational thought and irrational emotions. Yeah. So this division between rationality and thinking and irrationality and emotions is quite entrenched in the English language, or maybe you can extend to say in Western philosophy. Yeah. So and this filter into our everyday speech and the way we think, especially those of us most Singaporeans use English, yeah. And if you think in that language, it makes a lot of sense to talk about, you know, living in the head, and then talking about how the head is maybe different from the heart, you know. So we make this kind of metaphor, we use this kind of metaphor. So that means in our thinking, we separate the thinking process from the feelings, the emotions, and they seem sometimes almost contradictory to one another. You know? So that's why we would have, sometimes we have ideas like, emotions are like, can overwhelm our judgment and can negatively impact our clear thinking. Yeah. So this kind of fundamental ideas that affect how we think and therefore how we perceive our own experiences. In the Buddhist context, there isn't a word for emotions. In fact, the word that we commonly sometimes translate as emotions actually refer to different mental states or different mental factors. Yeah? But mental factors are not purely emotions and also not purely thought. In fact, I think quite often when in Buddhism we talk about, let's say, the mental factor of anger. Anger includes all the thoughts of anger, all the feelings of anger, all the bodily experiences of anger, and therefore also the emotions of anger. Okay, so in the Buddhist context, the word anger is not just feelings, but it also includes the thinking, thoughts, yeah. And also, in fact, the whole package of all the experiences we associate with anger. So, so it's important to keep that in mind, yeah. So when we say working with emotions in the context of, with a Buddhist background, through meditation, we are not only working with feelings, with bodily sensations, we are also working with thoughts. Okay, it's all lumped together, yeah, and not separate. And I think this is actually a more realistic way of understanding what is happening within us, what is affecting our mind, because it's very unusual to have to get angry where there's only feelings and no thoughts, right? And also almost impossible to have only the thoughts but no feeling of anger, you know? Because if you only have the thoughts of anger, so like sort of angry thoughts but absolutely no feeling at all, it's almost like it isn't anger, right? But the reverse is also true, converse is also true, that if you feel angry, you're most probably harboring thoughts of anger. You know, you're like, oh, this troublemaker, what is he doing to me, and blah, 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 blah. And that you have probably a very elaborate story going through your head, you know, while you're experiencing anger. And the most obvious way to see that is when someone is angry and they're trying to tell you, or they explain to you, you know, like a friend is trying to tell you what was so upsetting to him or her, you know, and they express their anger, you know, they sort of explain to you their anger, and you can actually get a sense through the story they're telling, the thinking process behind their emotions of anger, okay? So when we work with emotions in this context, we are working with the whole package, the thoughts, the feelings, the bodily sensations, and everything, right? So that's what we are going to explore in this course, yeah. And the first thing that most people do when they come to meditation, especially if they want to use the meditation to help them deal with stress, and stress could be of different types, right? Sometimes stress could be related to anxiety. You know, anxiety triggered by many different things. Can be anger, can be... So there actually could be lots of emotions, yeah, behind the stress that people may be experiencing these days. Yeah. And so maybe you heard that, oh, meditation is good for you, good to deal with stress, can help you to de-stress, can help you to overcome your... I think more and more... The anxiety or depression, you know, these are all quite, usually involve quite strong emotions, right? And so I mentioned in the previous course, I noticed from the questions people ask me or the feedback or comments I get from people, not much in Singapore context though, because always faced with a silence when I ask them whether they have any question or not. But occasionally I heard something, people feedback to me. And the most common one over the years is this idea of using meditation as medication. You know? And in fact, it is like a pill, like that, like popping a pill. And in fact, we want the pill to work the first time around. The first very meditation, not even the first session, but the very first meditation, is to say, hey, how come I didn't get calm? How come my stress didn't disappear, you know, when I'm trying to meditate to distress? In fact, most people find meditation actually quite stressful because you try and try and try, it's not working, you know, it seems to be getting worse. And you probably notice your thoughts even more. And occasionally when I taught some kind of mindfulness course, people complain, they say that before I start the meditation, I feel perfectly fine. After I meditate, I feel all the aches and pain, and you know, it becomes much more obvious or much more exaggerated. And I usually say, it has nothing to do with me. You probably already experienced the aches and pain, but you just didn't notice it, that's all. Yeah, which I think is true. Yeah, meditation, the first thing meditation, different type of meditation, but the first thing that it kind of enhance is actually the power of our attention, our awareness. After all, meditation primarily is a training in attention, how we pay attention, how we make use of our attention, or how we misuse our attention. So as you improve on your awareness and attention, of course you notice more things. You notice all the thoughts that may be preoccupying you. You notice all the tension within your body. And you may also notice the feelings, you know, that has been that is within you. You see them clearer. Yeah. So the first meditation today, I would like you to explore this idea of not using meditation as medication, right? Medication, or at least the way I see how quite a lot of people use meditation, is to control emotions, right? I feel anxious. If I meditate, the anxiety should go away. I feel upset. I meditate, the upsetness will go away, you know? And then immediately I'll feel calm, peaceful. But I thought, well, if you have a hole in your roof, right? No, even after you meditate, the hole in the roof will still be there, right? You know, if you have no money in your bank, you meditate, and after you come out of your blissful meditation, there is still no money in the bank, right? So meditation never really solves your problem in this sense. And therefore, it's not realistic to expect it to do that, right? That's the first thing to keep in mind. And also, it is not wise to try to control your emotions. Control emotion means, I want the emotion, it should come on demand. Like these days, you know, like StarHub, you know, you press, and then the screen will come up. If you want to watch this, press the blue button and subscribe immediately. Then you will get your video on demand, you know. So we are so used to this, press this, and you get this, press that, you get that. Yeah. Or change channel, you know. Like I used to do channel surfing. This day I don't do, but I don't know, I used to channel surf. I watch boring things like telemarketing, you know, people sell all sorts of things, sell blankets, sell ironing board, this kind of thing, right? So you channel surf. Control. The sense that you somehow there is something in your life you can control, including your feelings. Why? Especially when life felt most out of control, right? Very uncertain, overwhelmed with anxiety and feelings that are very unpleasant, but absolutely refuse to be in your control, right? Wouldn't go away when you want it to. Therefore, we naturally want something like meditation, no? To grant us the control that we want or crave for. And unfortunately, you will be disappointed. In fact, I hope you will be disappointed. Because if you ever gain control of your emotions through meditation, it is bad news. Because you would have enter a state or condition called addiction. You know, that's what happened, right? You know, addiction to a drug. Why? Because if I pop the drug in, I feel instantly blissful. I am in control. Then what happened if the drug wear off? I must go and make money and buy the drug and pop again, right? Because otherwise, without a drug, life cannot be in control. Other ways of control may be gambling. You know? I don't know what to think about it. In Australia, in a lot of the clubs, you know, like football clubs, return servicemen club, the most popular machine is the poker machine. You know? These days, don't need to do that. This day is by press. And this day, I think you can use credit card or whatever. Just press and then the poker machine, the thing, yeah. A lot of people spend hours doing it. Right? Because you derive a certain kind of feelings from doing that, right? And that helps you to control. By having those feelings, you control the unpleasant feelings. You don't have to think about things that upset you. You don't have to experience those uncomfortable, unpleasant feelings. Of course, until you run out of money, right? Then you have to stop playing. Gambling, drugs, computer games. I'm addicted to all sorts of things. Like Japanese anime. I like to binge watch. I don't like to wait for 1 week for the new one, then wait for another week. I like to watch them like 26 episodes all in one go. Why I do that? Because when I'm watching it, I experience pleasant feelings, right? And I don't have to experience the unpleasant feelings that come from like stress, like when the mind compulsively think about work or whatever it is that is bothering us. Okay, so that is control. And meditation, fortunately, is not about gaining that kind of control, right? Because that kind of control is a illusion, right? The whole idea of working emotion is not about controlling our emotions, because, as I said, when we do control, when we try to control our emotions, it tend to backfire. So what do I mean when we say we work with emotions? Now, emotions are our natural responses to the circumstances in our life, what is happening outside of us, inside of us. So we respond, right? We respond with different feelings, different emotions. And there's really not a good idea to deprive ourselves of that responses. In fact, I think modern research shows that emotions play a very important part in our choice making, our decision making, as well as us carrying out action, taking action to deal with things, right? So emotion is a very integral component of the way we respond to our life, right? If you deprive yourself of those emotions, you deprive yourself of a very important source of information, of motivation, right? So the whole idea of working emotion is not about controlling the emotion, cancelling out your emotions, getting rid of emotions, but about learning to learn from our own emotions so that we understand ourselves better. And also, the most important thing is to allow our emotions to flow smoothly, not to get stuck in our emotions. That is probably one of the major challenges we have. We get stuck in the emotions. We get stuck in anxiety. We get stuck in our anger. We get stuck in fear, and so much so to the extent that even when the actual situation has changed, the people has moved on, the event has, is long forgotten, we are still experiencing and re-experiencing those emotions. And that's where I think most of us find it's a form of suffering. Yeah. So when we work with emotions, we want it to flow. Not to not have the emotions, but to have the emotions that will flow and respond to the changing situation. So when it's time to be afraid, it's good to feel fear. And when the source of fear is gone, then it's good to not be afraid anymore. Right? Then it's time to be upset about something, then being upset is a natural response. And when there is time to experience love, care, and concern, then it was good to have loving feelings. Yeah, so it's good to have a different feeling. So the good analogy is like a river. A flowing river is a source of life, because as the flowing water, aerate, bring oxygen, nutrients, and to all the different organisms. Yeah, whereas if you compare that to a stagnant pool of water, it's good for mosquito breeding. These days, dengue fever, right? Stagnant water is not very conducive for, it's conducive for some form of life, but not many forms of life, right? So emotions are the same. It's good when emotions are flowing, It's not good when emotions are stagnant, right? So that is the idea, I hope, to convey, all right? So the first meditation is about, so how to get things moving, right? So there's this one very famous American Buddhist teacher, Pema Chodron. Some of you may have heard of her because she has some very very good book and very nice title. I think the publisher very good, very nice title. I can't remember. One of them is like The Wisdom of No Escape, and the others are Places That Scare Us or something like that. Things that titles that attract a lot of us in the modern world, and she's a good, very good meditation teacher. And she used the word ventilation. Ventilation? like, well, now we have ventilation. If I switch off all the aircon, you experience the lack of ventilation. You still feel very stuffy, you know, and doesn't feel very comfortable nor very healthy, you know. Whereas when you ventilate, that means you allow things to flow, you know, even if there may be something toxic or unhealthy. With ventilation, you can remove it. Of course, it may be polluting the environment, but no. Ventilations help things to move, to flow, to change. Right? So you can think of this first meditation, a very simple one, as a means to ventilate things. Okay? So this first meditation is the simple one, using the breath. Right? I will explain later a bit clearer for those who are new to my class, how to meditate on the breath. But the main idea when we do this meditation is it's not so much about control, but about helping things to flow, to move. And the breath is a very interesting object of meditation. It's one of those few things within our experience where we either can exercise conscious control on the breath, like I say, take a deep breath now. You can do it, right? I hope so, yeah. When you cannot do it, you really need to go and see a doctor, okay? And other times, it's good that you don't need to exercise conscious control. You forgot that you are breathing, and yet you are still alive. How wonderful it is. You can surrender control, and your body will just breathe itself, isn't it? Right? So this interesting thing of the breath, this juxtapositioning of the two, either conscious control or unconscious control, this alternating between these two. Yeah. And when we first start to meditate on the breath, I need to watch the time because I can really talk and talk and talk. Yeah. Most people naturally control the breath. Right? Even if you tell yourself not to, you still control the breath. Okay? And in fact, you would continue to do this for a very, very long time. Right? And yet, there come a point in your meditation practice where suddenly, one day, you arrive and you have somehow relinquished control of your breath. And yet, you are still aware of the breath. And it's a very unusual experience. As if the breath just flows by itself. Your body seems to breathe itself. And there's no need, you don't need to say, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out, no need. And this switch is a good switch because you have managed somehow, without you knowing how, and you won't be able to know how, your unconscious process has taken over. Right? So I would like you to try to achieve this in this meditation. Give it a challenge to yourself. How do you surrender conscious control and allow an unconscious process to just happen by itself while you are still attending to it, while you are still aware of it, right? It's no good telling yourself, stop controlling it. Surrender my breath back to my body, right? There's nothing you can do consciously to make it happen. But you can facilitate it. You can create a condition that is favorable for it to happen, okay? So, and when it happens, then you realize that meditation is actually, it's not so difficult. No? I always try to tell people, please don't try harder. Just don't try harder. Right? Whatever you do, don't try harder. Okay? Trying harder means you use more effort. And how do you use more effort? Tense up. Use control. Tense this, tense that. Don't know what you tense, but then suddenly you realize, oh, I'm having a headache. Why would watching the breath cause you to have a headache, right? Because you are struggling, you are controlling, you unconsciously, you are tensing up your muscle. Whereas when you can relinquish that control, then you relax, no? This happened, no need so much effort, no effort at all. And then that meditation becomes effortless, right? That's what we're aiming for, okay? And the trick is, the way I do it is you make use of your out-breath. Every time you breathe out, at first it's not completely natural, but never mind. As you breathe out, in your mind you say the word, my magic word. You all know, right? My magic word. Okay? Release. Not relax. Release. Right? It's a profound difference. took me many years to realize this. You know, when I finally found the magic word, I abandoned the word relax, forget, release. I'm just joking, yeah? Yeah. What you're trying to do is, you're not trying to control the release. You're not trying to say, oh, release, 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 release. But you're just reminding yourself, oh, there can be something can happen, which is release. No. Don't worry what you're releasing. It's just a reminder to your body and mind, oh, release. Okay? Right. So, let's do one meditation and then we can continue with it. Alright, so if you are new to my class, I present meditation in a three-step process. I just made it up, yeah. So first step is what I call acquiring a seat. So try to find comfortable posture and a seat for your body, one that allows you to sit comfortably without causing you unnecessary pain or discomfort. Although most people don't believe me, the chair is a wonderful invention, right? When you feel sitting on the floor is very painful, please switch to a chair. And instantly all your pain will disappear. Okay? The most important aspect of this posture is your spine, your back. So don't have to tense up your back muscle to straighten your spine, but see if you can just sit in such a way to just allow your back, your spine to be upright in a very natural way. No need to, again, as I say, no need to try to control it. Just let it find its most comfortable position. One that allowed the chest to be open and for allow you to be able to breathe freely and easily. Now hands, you can rest your hands on both knees, or traditionally we put one hand on top of the other and then we rest them in your lap. So choose one that allow your shoulders to be relaxed, that you don't have to tense up your arm muscles to hold your hands or arm in any particular way. Eyes, you can close them completely if you want to. Feel free to open your eyes at any point of time if you do feel sleepy or if things are unclear or if you want to take a break from the meditation, you can just open your eyes, look around a bit. And then when you feel ready, you can close your eyes and continue the meditation. So let your body settle into this posture you have adopted. Become aware of sensations at the points of contact between your body and your seat, your cushion, your body and the floor. See if you can really experience your body in this posture is resting on something firm, solid, stable. Qualities we associate with the earth, with the ground, they are here to support you, to hold up your body. So allow your body in this posture to rest comfortably in a well-balanced and safe manner on your seat, on the ground. And the second step is to take some time to help our body and mind to transition into meditation. So this session we're going to make use of our breath, our natural breath. So as much as you can, even though it's not really possible consciously, just keep in mind there is no need to control your breath. There is no such thing as a perfect breath. So see if you can just become aware of the breath sensations in the different parts of your body. So usually people notice the breath maybe around the nostrils. They can feel the touch of air as it flows in and out. Or maybe at the chest, the sense of expansion and contraction of your chest. Some people notice the breath at the abdomen as it rises and falls with each breath. So your breath can be long or short, can be deep or shallow. can be slow or fast. See if you can just allow your breath to just be. And let the breath be an anchor or support for your attention. And throughout the meditation, all you need to do is to return your attention to the breath, come back and be in touch and be aware of the breath sensations in the body again and again. You don't have to make your attention stay on the breath. You don't have to put in any effort to somehow focus on the breath continuously. That's not necessary. All you need to do is to return your attention again and again, to come back and be in touch with your own breath. So coming back to the breath, as you notice the sensations of the breath, see if you can give special attention to your out-breath. Notice as you breathe out, there is a very subtle sense of relaxation that comes along with it, as the muscles of your diaphragm and your chest relax. So the out-breath is an opportunity to release, just as the body releases the stale air in the lungs. Likewise, other things can be released, other things that are unwanted or unhelpful may also flow away with the breath. Maybe some unnecessary tightness or tension in your body may also go with the breath. Maybe the thoughts, words and images that pop into your mind during the meditation. And maybe some of them can also go with the breath, so that you don't have to follow the thoughts, you don't have to complete the thoughts. You can just allow them to flow away with the breath. So as you come back to the breath, as you notice your out-breath, see if you can make use of the magic word release as you breathe out in your mind, to remind yourself, to remind your body and mind that they can release. So coming back to your breath sensations again and again, we take the first few minutes of each meditation to give our body and mind some time, some space to unwind, to loosen up, to set aside unnecessary tensions in the body, to put aside thoughts and images, memories and fantasies that are not related to the meditation. We can allow all this to be released with your out-breath. So as you become aware that your attention may have drifted away from the breath, you might find that your attention has drifted away to thoughts about the past or the future or some ongoing commentary. So know that this is quite normal. And all you need to do when you become aware of it is to choose to come back to the breath. Come back, reconnect with the breath sensations in your own body, and as you breathe out, remind yourself to release. Coming back to be in touch with the breath sensations in your body. The third step of the meditation is what I call deepening meditation. And in this case, we simply continue the same technique, the same method of returning our attention, be in touch with your own breath, and with each out-breath, remind yourself, maybe with the word release. To allow your body and mind to release unnecessary tension, unwanted thoughts, and also to release the control we somehow unconsciously exercise over the breathing process. We return the breath to the body and allow the body to breathe itself. And all you need to do to achieve that is to come back to the breath, and now and then as you breathe out, remind yourself to deepen the sense of release. So as you return your attention to the breath again and again, as you emphasize with the word release, with each out-breath, along the way you become more aware of the states of your body and mind. You notice more things, what is actually happening within your own body, what is actually happening in your mind, even though all you are doing is returning your attention to the breath. So see if you can notice the state of your body. Notice which parts of your body may feel tight, tense, or uncomfortable. Also notice which part of your body may feel quite relaxed, at ease, comfortable. And all along, see if you can just return your attention to the breath. And also notice the state of your own mind, the quality of your attention. Does the mind still feel fairly excited, agitated, quite a lot of thoughts and images coming and going? Are you feeling a bit sleepy or drowsy as the meditation progresses? Or maybe you notice that the mind is fairly awake, alert, and calm. So without the need to judge good and bad, just notice and be more aware of the states of your body and mind. And then finally, to conclude the meditation, in your mind you can make a dedication, thinking that may anything positive that come out of the meditation, anything beneficial, may they stay with you, may they somehow linger in your body and mind and continue to benefit you long after your meditation is over. So that's about 20 minutes of meditation. So far, okay? Do you have a blissful meditation? Effortless meditation. That's my aim. How can you meditate effortlessly? And work so hard and try so hard and to struggle against this and struggle against that. How wonderful if it just happen and happen. Happen now effortlessly, and before you know it, you say, oh, I'm so calm and peaceful and I'm at ease. Yeah, isn't that wonderful? So over the subsequent weeks I will develop this meditation further. So I'm going to present two different types or two different track of meditations for working on emotions, and this is the first track, right? Something to do with the breath and so on. Yeah. Okay, any question about or comments about this, what I presented so far? Yes. Beyond the meditation. So, during the meditation, so the question is, during the meditation, when you can transition from a state of a dualistic kind of experience where you have a sense of observer and observer, or meditator an object of meditation into a non-dual state, you know, a non-realistic kind of experience, then how do you sustain it beyond the meditation? Yeah. First of all, because maybe most people would say how you go from a dualistic to a non-realistic first, right? Same as just as you cannot control and say, okay, now it's time to switch from a dualistic mode of meditation to a non-dualistic mode. Likewise, you cannot control, you know, as to whether after you finish your meditation, how long or how you can sustain the meditation experience into your post-meditation session. Yeah. So the thing is not so much how I can do it, but to become more sensitive and understand what are the conditions that facilitates any kind of a meditative experience. You know? So certain conditions come together and you have a particular meditative experience arise, be it calmness or blissfulness, or as you talk about, non-dual experience, experience, a very unusual experience in which you don't feel that there is a meditator and there is an object of meditation. You don't feel like, oh, I must watch the breath. No, it's just if there's just the breath, and somehow there is the knowing of the breath, but they don't have this sense of observer and observe. Yeah, you can't make it happen, but you can come to understand certain conditions come together, and then this experience manifests, arise. No, and just as when it happened in meditation, likewise it also happened outside of meditation. So when certain conditions gather together, then you find that usually it happens when you look at the sunset, you know, and the beautiful sunset on the beach, and it's descending, and you feel at one with the universe, you know, and there's only the sun setting. It never happened to me. Every time there's a beautiful sunset, I try. Where I have this non-dualistic oneness experience, like one with everything, you know, there's this joke about. It's actually a real event. This TV presenter, and this is in Australia, and he was interviewing the Dalai Lama, and he was trying to tell him a joke. Yeah, the joke is when someone walk into a Buddhist monk or whatever, or the Dalai Lama, walk into a pizza kind of shop, you know, the one where you can choose different topping, and he ordered, "Can I have one with everything?" And then the Dalai Lama doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. Yeah, so this idea of non-dual and one with everything. And I never managed to consciously make it happen. You know, on those situations or where people say, "Oh, they're one with sunset, with the music, with everything." My mind is always very distracted. Is this the one with everything experience? Clearly, it's not, right. Yeah. But what happened is when we least expected it, when we are not consciously looking for it, conditions may gathered, and then you are already in it. But when you're in it, you cannot have this kind of evaluative thoughts where you say, is this going to last? How am I going to continue it? How can I take it back? Right. But what happens is, over time, you learn, you kind of get a bit more aware of what sort of conditions must come together for it to happen. No, you get more and more sensitive to this gathering of conditions for something to happen. And you also become more aware of the dissociating of the conditions, and you know that, that experience is coming to an end. You know? So sometimes people, when they meditate, after a while, you know that, the meditation is going deeper. You know that conditions are coming together, and there is some kind of shift in your meditative experience. You know, and so you are going deeper. And then after a while, you don't know why, you can sense that the conditions that bring that about is falling apart, it's changing, and you know you are emerging from your meditation back into a more kind of usual kind of state of consciousness. You know, so that is that shift. And I think it's a very non-linear, kind of complex situation, so not something we can analyze easily. So as you become more and more sensitive to it, you become more and more familiar with it, and it becomes easier and easier without thinking about it for the conditions together. In fact, someone who has a lot of experience in meditation has been doing very well, they don't take much. They just sit in the posture and without doing anything. You can feel that the conditions are gathering and they will just automatically will enter into a state of meditation. And that state of meditation can last for long or short. And somewhere along the, and they don't think about it. They don't say, oh, I want to meditate a bit longer today. No. After a while, they feel something is moving, shifting. Then they know their meditation is coming to an end and they emerge from it. Yeah. And likewise, even after the meditation, no, without you doing anything at all, some of the experience will linger on. And again, it's not something we can control. But of course, the deeper your experience in meditation is, then the stronger will be the after effect when you emerge from your meditation. Is that okay? That's the best I can manage, yeah. Any other question? Okay, so that was about my meditation on the breath, about working on this idea of release, releasing control, relinquishing control, and learning to, instead of struggling and trying to control the breath and eventually the emotions, learn to facilitate release, learn to sort of facilitate the flow or the change of experiences, you know, so that we don't get stuck. In fact, emotions themselves are not good or bad. I mean, they can be pleasant or unpleasant. It is when we are stuck that it becomes suffering. And this is what in Buddhism we call craving or clinging. You know, when you cling, even though it's done unconsciously, you suffer. You get caught in a kind of pattern, a repetitive pattern of reactions that we instinctively know it's not good for us, but we just couldn't get out of it. You know? We get so sucked into it. Like people, usually it's very obvious when we are in some kind of relationship, kind of dispute in relationship. You know, you can really get sucked into it, and it can be sustained for years and years and years. And even when one of the parties is already dead and gone, you know, and you still get stuck in it. You know, so that is. When, normally, of course, when you're distracted, nothing happens, nothing. But when something reminds you of it, right, it's triggered, then you go back into that, like a whirlpool, like that. You know, you just go around, then after a while, okay, then you know, it can only sustain for so long, and you get sort of spit out, you know, and then you say, what has just happened to me? But that experience can be very unbearable sometimes. And so what we want to facilitate is not to cut off all the emotions, but instead of being spinning round and round, to just allow it to come and go, to flow, right? Okay, so that's one idea I want to present. So the second meditation we're going to do today is this second track that I want to present is we can also, when we work with emotions, the word is to cultivate certain states of mind. As I mentioned at the beginning, you know, we in the Buddhist context, we tend not to use the word emotions. We use factors or state factors, mental factors that influence our consciousness and influence our experience. Yeah. So we cultivate certain mental factors, certain states of mind or qualities of heart that are conducive to our happiness. You know, it's like a bit like immunizing yourself. No, you boost your immunity. So if you have a greater or stronger experience of some of these mental factors or qualities of heart, so that they come forth more readily, they become your more natural responses, then very automatically you will experience less of other type of reactions. So like for example, a very simple example is, if you familiarize yourself with what we call loving kindness, or to respond to events and things in life, our kindness, then it's more, when you feel kind towards somebody, it's less likely you feel angry at that person, or you react with anger or hatred or with harmful intent, right? So you come from a different place, and therefore you have a different feelings, a different way of thinking and looking at a situation, and therefore a different behavior, and out of it you get a different response from the other person, right? And this comes from the heart, not from the head. Oh, I should be kind. At least I should look kind. You know, what I call keeping up appearance. You know, like, especially people like me that sit like this. You know, Buddhist teacher must keep up appearance. I must be compassionate. It's very demanding. You know. So I'm very compassionate. So I really very pissed off. I must compassionate. Then they will tell you, you must be compassionate. I don't particularly feel like compassionate. Yeah. Then one of my friends said, because we have this thing called Bodhisattva vow. It's the vows that we take to be altruistic. Say, if you follow your Bodhisattva vow, you should do this for me. I said, I don't particularly feel like doing it today for you. This is called emotional blackmailing. Yeah. People do that, yeah. Yeah. Especially in a spiritual circle. But the thing is, a lot of time we, especially when you come in, like in kind of spiritual context, yeah, we carry a lot of ideas in our head. You know, what it means to be compassionate, what it means to be kind, what it means to be selfless and altruistic. We don't really feel like that, you know, but we have an idea in our head, and we try to live from that idea. We try to speak from that idea and act from that idea. Unfortunately, an idea is just an idea, you know. And you have harbored other type of feelings, very deep, strong, natural feelings. And we are all very smart. When someone talks to us, even though they say, I speak to you very respectfully and politely, we sense the undercurrent of their emotions expressed through what we call non-verbal cue, and we don't believe a single word you said. No. Right? Then people go on defensive, because they sense the aggression underneath it, the anger, the resentment. Even though you sound like a really good Buddhist teacher, they know that it's not true. Okay? So because why? It doesn't come from the heart. It comes from certain ideas and image we accumulate in our mind. And of course, we're trying our best, you know? We try our best to behave in a civilized way, to be as polite or as the best we can do, lah. No, usually the best is not good enough, lah. No. So when we work with emotions, we work with, of course, we try our best. We still sort of, you know, keep up the appearance part, but we want to work on a deeper level. We want to, the change has to come from a deeper place, and only then can we be able to establish genuine communication with other people. And because you come from a different place in the heart, and they sense that difference. And then they can often overlook the actual words you say because they sense that it comes from a very different place. And then you can have a very different conversation, right? So that's why it's important to work from the heart, to reach and touch the heart. And don't worry too much about all these ideas that, you know, you should be like this, and you should be like this, you should not do that, you should not do this. I mean, of course, it's good, you know, that is like kind of a way of presenting ethics, but ethics also needs to come from the heart, from a kind heart. Yeah. And only then will we experience the genuineness, or these days, no, not maybe not, some years ago, people talk about authenticity, you know, to be authentic. Right? Then only then can you experience authenticity, and only then can people notice it and respond to it. Make sense? Yeah. So this is working with emotions, but from the heart. And how to reach the heart? It's not so easy, right? I told some of you attend, I'm a lot of difficulty working with emotion, feelings, no? Like I cannot feel on demand, right? No. So we're going to meditate on loving kindness. I usually don't feel very loving when I do loving kindness meditation, right? Because how to feel on demand, right? But over the years, I learned there are methods that we can work on to help us to access the heart, you know, to reach, not, it doesn't work every time, you know, because sometimes I do a loving kindness meditation and it's some of the most boring meditation in the world, you know, or sometimes I actually feel angry because I, you know, you bring this person to mind and you try to be loving, then suddenly you remember all the irritating thing this person has done to you. Say, oh. And especially when people against my advice, they like to, they're very strange. I say, choose an easy person to start with to radiate loving kindness. You know what they do? They choose the most difficult person. They choose their worst enemy. Almost as if I don't start with the most difficult one, it's not worth meditating on. And then they realize how difficult it is, right? So instead of being loving, they got angry all over again, which is why they call this person the difficult person, isn't it? It's difficult. That's why it's difficult, yeah. Start from an easy one. And we try to, with an easy person, try to, in relation to this person, to be able to reach in and touch that the heart, so-called the heart, you know, to bring forth a loving response to this person. Right? So that is how we cultivate or meditate on loving kindness. All right? So I warn you, don't start with the most difficult person in your life. Okay? You will not get very good results. Right? Yeah. So how do we access the heart? There are different ways, and I can only present you the way that I meditate in, the way I know best. Yeah, I use words. I use simple phrases. Anyway, after you attend a few of my sessions, I'm always the same old thing. Right? I just go over and over again. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is whether you try out and see whether it works for you or not. Right? Why I use words? Because when days and moments where I don't feel loving, I still have the support of the words. And the words become the vehicle for me to reinforce and convey the intention. Now, I may not have the feeling, but I have the intention. Intention of kindness. Intention that at least with words I try to wish you well. Even though in that moment I don't particularly feel like it. You know, or I cannot touch the feeling. Right? But this is a very important thing because in day-to-day life, very often it is the intention. Right? It is the intention that guide our actions towards the people in our life. And when we hold fast to the intention, then even when we don't particularly feel loving, right, at least we come from a good place, a place of good intention. Right? Okay. So we must try to express that intention in a way that's meaningful to us, not necessarily to others, but meaningful to us. And so I use my four stock phrases, and you're most welcome to change them, you can add on to them, change the wordings. So I will wish, may you live in safety. All right. My friend laughed at me and said, do you feel dangerous? Do you feel like you live dangerously? I don't feel I live dangerously, but there are times in my life I feel very insecure. I feel there's a lot of uncertainty in life, and I just cannot make it secure, right? So I have to face the uncertainty, and I appreciate how difficult it is, right? So I felt in order to be happy, first, you really need to have that sense of safety. So may you live in safety. The second one is, may you be happy. Happy in the sense that you have this lightness of mind and heart that you, people tell you a joke, you can laugh. Because I'm a pessimist, right? So I tend to experience the opposite reaction. So it's very nice when you feel very light, very cheerful, very joyful at heart. May you be happy, right? May you be healthy. Because when the body doesn't feel, not working well, lots of aches, lots of pain, it's very hard to be happy, right? So may you be healthy. And the last one, may you live with ease. Like, things, just whatever you do, just happen easily, smoothly. No, you don't have to put in a lot of effort. I'm very lazy by nature. Don't have to put in a lot of effort. Don't have to struggle. You know, have a lot of hassles. No, just everything just happen miraculously, one after another. May you live with ease. May you live in safety. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. So, in this technique, you use the words to convey the intention of loving kindness and direct it, and almost like you say it to this person or whoever, and also you say it to yourself. You wish for yourself, may I live in safety, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live with ease. All right? And the good thing about this technique is then I can feel whatever I feel like in that moment. You know? It doesn't matter. You know, sometimes I feel nothing. Not sometimes. Most of the time, I feel nothing. And it's fine. You know, I just, there's still the words. I can just mindfully, slowly, attentively just repeat the words. Then occasionally, hey, there's this nice, warm feeling. You know, when you say the words seems to come out, at least in the mind, with a sense of warmth. I actually feel quite loving, you know. Surprise. But anyway, you know. And that was very nice, pleasant, right? Then other times you may feel bored, you feel irritated, you know, you know, all sorts of other feelings. You know. But that's fine, you know, they can come and go because the anchor is with the words, the intention. And when the loving feeling arises, I ask people to entwine the loving feeling around the words and then just offer it to yourself or to others. Right? I should give people an image of what it conveys. I live in Australia for 10 years, so I sort of kind of get a little bit westernized. And then I like to watch British crime things. You know, actually, there's this series called Midsummer Murder. Yeah, it's very British. And it's a murder in those village, you know. Not those village, those little. In fact, we always joke because there are many seasons of this Midsummer province, right? Every season, every episode, someone died, right? It's probably had the highest murder rate in the entire United Kingdom, right? And as this very English way, you know, when something happened, something upsetting, they found a body or whoever, you know, they will always say, "Come, madam, sit down, and let me make you a cup of tea." That cup of tea is very, very special. You know, it seems to be able to solve everything, calm you down. There was also another series, also British, where this woman, she returned home. It was during the Second World War. The bit, and her entire house was bombed. So basically everything is gone except the kitchen table. And this police officer said, "Come, madam, sit down. Let me make you a cup of tea in the ruins of your house," no? And I find it quite heartwarming, you know. This cup of tea, or kappa, as they call it in Australia. It conveys a sense of, a gesture of kindness. Not necessarily like love, you know, great love like that, but just trying to be kind. Not that it necessarily work, but at least, you know, it's just a very small gesture, just a cup of tea, right? Right. It doesn't really work in Singapore, but no. But anyway, no. But the idea, the image, and the feeling behind it. So every time you say a word, the line, it's a gesture, offering a gesture of kindness, of understanding, of well wishing, right, to yourself and to others. It's just a very tiny gesture, but actually, love, real true love, it's not about huge, big sacrifice. And quite often it's just those little gesture that convey to another person or to yourself that you care, that you have paid attention, and that you're just trying your best. All right? Makes sense? Okay, so let's do a meditation on that. So I think the first act of kindness to yourself when you meditate is please choose a posture that doesn't cause you suffering, right? So there are still chairs available. So if you really need to just sit on a chair, please sit on the chair, okay? All right, so I'm going to repeat the three steps. So first step, acquiring a seat. So find a posture that allows your body to be well supported and allow the back, the spine to be upright in a natural way. So give your body a few moments to find its way into this posture, making sure that the posture allows your body to feel well supported, balanced, and safe, so that in its own time, your body can begin the process of just simply loosening up, unwinding, feeling that it doesn't need to be so tense, to be so tight, that it can release all those unnecessary tension and tightness and find its way into the posture. And the second step of the meditation, what I call helping your body and mind to make transition into the meditation. So again, for a few minutes, we're going to rely on the breath. So see if you can just place your attention on the breath sensations in your body for a while. Allow yourself to feel your in-breath and your out-breath. So without controlling the breath, just allow the breath to flow naturally. Experience the in and out breath, especially your out breath. And each time you notice yourself breathing out, remind your body and mind with the word release. Breathing out, this is a wonderful opportunity for your body and mind to release, to set aside all the unnecessary, unwanted things preoccupying your body and your mind. Actually, a good place to begin is with our face. So often we unconsciously tense up the facial muscles. You know, when we are stressed, when we encounter something new or difficult, we naturally tense up the muscles in the face. Maybe those in the forehead, or those in your jaw, or muscles around the eyes. So breathing out, see if you can maybe release some of those tension in your face. And out of kindness to yourself, let in a feeling of softness into the face, a feeling of ease and comfort and relaxation into your own face. So remind yourself that meditation is not really about trying harder, trying to squeeze something out of the meditation. Rather, it's about learning to direct your attention, channel your attention in a skillful way, towards a positive direction. So in this meditation, in the third step of this meditation, what I call deepening meditation, we're going to deepen the cultivation of loving kindness. In order to do that, we make use of a few simple phrases. So see if you can take a few moments and choose a few simple phrases, a few simple sentences that best convey your understanding of what it means to love. And allow the phrases to be the vehicle for you to convey loving kindness. So you can start with the one that I recommend and change the wordings as you go along. Phrases such as, may I live in safety. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. So in this third step to deepen the meditation, I suggest you start with yourself. Just simply select a few phrases and repeat them to yourself slowly, mindfully. Stay connected with the intention behind the words and offer them to yourself. May I live in safety. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. So making use of the words as a support, slowly at your own pace and in your own way, just repeat the sentences, the phrases, and offer that positive intention of loving kindness towards yourself, really wishing yourself to be well and happy from the bottom of your own heart. May I live in safety. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. So along the way, you will notice your attention doesn't stay with the words, the phrases. It may wander off elsewhere. And that is quite normal. And see if you can respond with kindness without being upset or frustrated. Just very gently remind yourself and come back to the words and start again. May I live in safety. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. There is no need to control your feelings, no need to manufacture loving feelings. In fact, as I said earlier, allow your feelings to come and go, to flow naturally. And occasionally, warm, loving feelings may arise in your heart. Then entwine them with the words so that you can reinforce it and offer it back to yourself. May I live in safety. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. So coming back to the phrases of loving-kindness again and again, see if you can, at your own pace, repeat and offer the phrases to yourself. Think of each phrase as a gesture expressing the intention of love and kindness, and direct it first to yourself, wishing yourself to have happiness and the causes of happiness. May I live in safety. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I live with ease. And then we can shift the focus, turn our attention to those closest to us, those in our family, our friends. And we're going to repeat the same process and offer phrases of loving kindness to them one at a time. So bring to mind someone close to you. And as you bring the person to mind, you may even visualize the person or recollect a recent encounter with this person. Take a few moments to take a good look at this person. We are maybe too busy lately. We haven't paid too much attention, especially to those that we are most familiar and we are most close to. So take a look at this person. This person is just like us. He or she wants to be happy, working hard to gather the causes of their happiness, and does not want to suffer. And see if you can, from the bottom of your heart, convey your love, your sense of kindness towards this person, using similar words, wishing, may you live in safety, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. And as I mentioned before, don't expect strong feelings of loving kindness. Instead, allow the feelings to come and go. Don't be too concerned about them. And place your attention on the words and the intention behind those words, and direct them towards those closest to you, one at a time. May you live in safety. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. Coming back to the person, coming back to your phrases of loving kindness. So feel free to switch from one person to another at your own pace. You can spend a long time or a short time with each person according to your wish. But with each one of them, see if you can, at least with as much sincerity you can find with your own heart. See if you can say the words sincerely and offer loving kindness to those that are close to you. May you live in safety. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. So coming back to the meditation on loving kindness, feel free to move from one person to another at your own pace, and with each one of them, see if you can offer the similar phrases of loving kindness and direct the intention of love towards each one of them, and allowing feelings to come and go.
And finally, to conclude the meditation, one way is to imagine gathering up all this positive momentum you have created in this meditation on loving kindness, and just direct this positive momentum to what we call dedication. Just dedicate that may this positive energy or positive momentum that you have created here today, dedicate it towards the fulfillment of your higher aspirations, and dedicate it towards the well-being of yourself and others. Okay, so that is a short meditation on loving kindness, and the important thing is to understand that the aim of the meditation is not to manufacture and then to somehow pump up the emotions of what we call love. Yeah, it's not a Korean drama to sort of like pull at your heartstring and you feel very loving and you feel very teary, and it's not terribly sentimental kind of meditation, unfortunately. So it's really about cultivating and helping us to get in touch with the natural heartfelt quality of loving kindness that we all have within ourselves, you know, so that we become more familiar with it, we are more in touch with it, and we facilitate it to arise as a natural response towards ourselves and towards others. So we are kind of reinforcing, let's say, a good habit, you know, a good way of responding to self and others. And any question? Yes. The seat, meditation, yeah. Oh, okay. So the question is, because I usually present meditation in these three steps, as I said, I invented them, all right? It's easy for me to say step one, step two, step three, yeah. So you're always acquiring the seed, helping your body and mind to make transition, and then deepening meditation. And how come in other texts, including my own teacher, will teach there's another step before, which is to set your motivation, right? And it somehow mysteriously disappeared when I present meditation. Actually, there's what they call the two activities: one at the beginning and one at the end. One at the beginning is setting a good motivation, and the one at the end is called dedication, right? So dedication is like a bit suka-suka, you know, like a good mood that I dedicate, like not good mood, I forgot about it, you know. But then this motivation step, I never mention it. I never ask you to have a good motivation. Think about sentient beings instead of yourself. Why? Because as I mentioned earlier, how a person presents meditation or teach meditation very much fall back on their own life experiences and where they come from. I realized sometime quite a number of years ago, after 20 years of mumbling this, I will do this meditation for the benefit of all sentient beings. I've been mumbling that everything I do, I eat, I mumble, I meditate, I mumble, I say prayers, I mumble. Then I realized all I ever did is just mumbling, you know. And my motivation hasn't changed at all. Has always been as pure as I first started it long time ago. All I think about is myself anyway,
No, I just want to be happy. Then I said, well, so why mumble? No, after 20 years, it still didn't change. Then it can change, but it doesn't change by me mumbling to myself, oh, I will do this meditation for the benefit of all sentient beings. Right? If it's not authentic, it's not authentic. So another way of thinking about it is, I accept any motivation that you have for coming here and meditate. Anyway, it's not my business, right? It's your responsibility. So whatever motivation that got you through the door and get here, it's fine. Because I used to do marketing, you see. And I told the people that courses that I market for, my job is to get the person through the door. What happened afterwards is your own business. And if they don't come back, don't blame me, okay? So this whole idea of motivation is, again, is about, this is the way I look at it, it's about control, right? Motivation is also something deep in the heart, something that moves us, you know? And of course we can change our motivation, but we don't necessarily change our motivation just by telling ourselves that I meditate for the benefit or whatever it is, yeah. So I actually find that step at the beginning, in my case, is like putting a veneer over whatever that I already have, right? It's like, you know, painting, right? You paint oil paint and then you put a veneer over it, yeah? So it covers what is underneath it, but it doesn't actually, it's supposed not to change, right? That's the whole idea of having a veneer, you know? And that's what happened in my own experience. This first step of setting the motivation didn't actually change my motivation. All it does is it masks over my true motivation behind meditation. And therefore, since it doesn't work for me, it doesn't change my motivation, I prefer to leave it out and just acknowledge whatever motivation I have in that moment that got me there to start meditating. But also I believe that motivation change. The meditation itself can change the motivation, like this loving kindness thing, right? So I might start off meditating because of one reason, and through cultivating loving kindness, maybe later on I suddenly notice that my motivation has transformed along the way. And that change happened organically in the heart. And I feel that that is more authentic, and it's true, and it works. So to summarize, I feel that there's no need to, I mean, that I'm not against people doing it, right? But in my case, I'm quite happy to leave it out, this first step of setting the motivation, because I have much greater confidence in the process of meditation itself, that if your meditation works, it's effective, it actually can, as it transforms your heart, it also transforms your motivation, what bring you to meditate or to do whatever it is. Yeah. That's it? Explain? Okay. But you can also set the motivation. I'm sure you do much better than me, you know. You're not spraying veneer over, you know, all sorts of more self-centered kind of motivation. But I generally, after all these years of meditating, I realized that my motivation for meditation is simple, and it's just like what started me like maybe more than 30 years ago when I first came across the meditation. I just find it's just something enjoyable to do. You know? I don't do it in an altruistic way, but I just enjoy meditating, and I find it kind of fun and as a wonderful journey of discovering our own mind, the functioning of our own mind, and I derive a lot of benefits from it, you know? So it's quite simple. And after a while, I decided that, well, since it got me meditating for 30 over years, I think it's fine, you know? Okay? Right? So that's it for this week. So next week, I'll continue this theme, these two tracks. And thank you for your attention, and have a good weekend. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. No need to clap. Maybe leave the cushions behind, and maybe just move the chairs back for me.